Welcome to the Hell Yes Life podcast, where you'll hear inspiring stories and life lessons from amazing Hell Yes entrepreneurs who are running their for-purpose businesses and living their Hell Yes lives. I'm your host, Norman Bell. Hey, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Hell Yes Entrepreneur Podcast. I am your host, Norman Bell, and I'm excited today. I have as my guest, Steve Simon. So let me tell you about Steve. By the age of 29, Steve had traveled and studied in 30 countries and worked on three continents as a robotics engineer and management consultant. While on an assignment in Paris, he had a series of experiences that caused him to re-examine his path. He decided to become an artist, move to California, and open his own art gallery. He has since authored 7 books of his art. He is currently working on a collection of paintings depicting 36 of the great peacemakers. The collection will be published in his next book and will include lessons gleaned by the artist from studying these luminaries. You can view that work in progress at thegreatpeacemakers.com and his broader portfolio at stevesimon.com. Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Norman. Great to be here this morning.
Yeah, great to have you. And before we get started, I just wanted to note to our listeners, because I think it's kind of fun, I met Steve a few months ago when I was doing a little R&R trip in Sedona, and I was in this art shop, or a shop that has art from local artists. And I had chosen this print. Actually, if you're watching on video, I'll just show you the print. I have it right here. This print, a beautiful print of rock formations in Sedona, took it up to the counter and said, "Yeah, I think I'd like this one." And the person behind the counter said, "Oh, well, here's the artist right here that painted that." And so I had a great conversation with Steve, and we've kept in touch since. There was some good synchronicity.
That must be your serendipitous Hell Yes Life working for you.
There it is. Yeah. Hell Yes Lifers, you guys know out there listening that when you start following your path, well, you encounter some blocks sometimes, but you also have these kind of synchronistic events. So anyway, Steve, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I want to get into your story, from top to bottom, but I always like to start by asking my guests, what is your hell yes? What is that thing that really lights you up and makes you come alive?
Well, for me, it's definitely art. As a kid, I love to draw and paint and do those kinds of things. And I also had something of a math and science aptitude, you know, so I thought, well, math and science and art, maybe I should study architecture, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I was from Chicago originally and looked at different schools in the Midwest and had applied to Iowa State's architecture program and was accepted there. And the summer before school was going to start, I visited the campus and went to go see a professional counselor, guidance counselor. And he said, "Steve, why architecture?" And I said, "Architecture?" And he said, "Yeah, you know, it's a difficult curriculum. You study 5 years, you don't make that much money. You know, why architecture?" And I told him, you know, math, science, and my hobby is art. And he said, "You know, if you're good in math and science, make that your profession. If you're good in art, make that your hobby. You know, I recommend you become an engineer." So really from the get-go, you know, I was experiencing, I think what probably a lot of your listeners experiences is this kind of sociological coaching into doing that which is practical within the economy that we all live in, you know. Yeah. So I was coached out of my passion and into the practical. And at the time, you know, I was an impressionable 17-year-old. I thought these were wise words, and they probably were. And so I thought to myself, why design a house that sits there when I could design a machine that moves, you know? Mm-hmm. So I studied mechanical engineering with an emphasis in robotics, and then after school took a job in Germany as a robotics engineer, expecting this to be an exciting, creative profession, you know? And I think for a lot of people, it probably is. My particular path, that didn't prove to be the case. And I got a little bit frustrated with the idea that I was going to become this expert on the manufacturing of a hydroelastic engine mount that went on the bottom of a car, you know, for maybe a decade of my life. You know, it didn't sound very creative to me. So it was time to start looking at some other things. And so I came back to the States and sort of parlayed that robotics experience into doing management consulting work with one of the big six at the time, where we went into manufacturing facilities and help things run more productively, efficiently, and automated things. Well, they sent me all over creation. It lasted for about 5 years. My colleagues who were leaving those jobs were either getting similar jobs in the field or going back to school, typically to get an MBA. And I thought, well, maybe if I get an MBA, that'll open up some other ideas. Maybe I'll do something entrepreneurial from that. You know, that was kind of the idea. And I'd really gotten a taste for the international life and wanted to continue to pursue that. So I found this French program where you study in Paris, New York, and Tokyo with seminars throughout Eastern Europe and East and Southeast Asia, and found it fascinating. Really cool group. It was only 50 students from 25 countries, and we traveled in lockstep together around the world. And it was just this fascinating program. I was elected class president, graduated at the top of the class, and thought, well, now what am I going to do? Mm-hmm. You know, I ended up taking a job in Paris, and my employer provided me with an apartment, this kind of temporary apartment in Montmartre. And if your listeners out there have been to Paris, maybe they've been to Montmartre. You know, this is kind of for an artist, this is sort of the high altar of art in the world. Any sort of who's who of oil painting has passed through, you know, the streets and alleys of Montmartre, you know. And so here I am, I find myself in Paris, you know, asking myself a lot of these existential questions of, like, man, what am I really supposed to do, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I would spend a ton of time in the galleries and in the museums and art studios in Paris and even more specifically in Montmartre. And I think everything in my life was pointing back to art, and I was somehow resisting this, you know, make it your hobby, right? Like this wise sage had told me. And Paris has these wonderful concerts in the cathedrals. And I used to go to Notre Dame and other cathedrals and listen to these tremendous classical music concerts. And I'd bring a sketch pad with, and I would sketch what was on my mind, or sometimes the interior architecture or statuary. And this one night, I went to Saint-Germain-des-Prés, which is other side of Paris, famous for some of the existentialist thinkers that passed through Paris, Jean-Paul Sartre and others. And there was this great performance of Mozart's Requiem in Saint-Germain-des-Prés. And I got there, and the gentleman selling the tickets said, that it's sold out. I'm sorry. And I said, oh, no, you know. And he said, oh, I see you're by yourself, which was kind of a knife to my side, because I had gone to Paris partly chasing this French girl who dumped me the first day I got there in favor of a job to go to London. So anyway, there I am, and he says, I see you're by yourself. And I said, yeah, I'm by myself, you know. And he says, well, we have individual seats left, but they're very bad, you know? And I said, very bad? How bad could they be? You know, I'll take whatever you got. And what was fascinating about these seats was that the orchestra had taken up the position of where the altar in the cathedral would normally be, and the choir was back behind them, architecturally speaking, the apse of the church. And this seat of mine was wedged in between the orchestra and the choir, right next to the timpani drums, oddly enough. So this is why the seat was so bad, because acoustically it was a disaster, but visually it was amazing, because I was looking directly at the conductor instead of his back. I was looking directly at the conductor from the vantage point of a musician.
Oh, wow.
Sorry to say, from the timpani drums, and I had to listen to a lot of rumbling. But it was an amazing seat. And what was really incredible about it, Norman, and this is really the moment where it clicks for me, is I'm watching this conductor, right? And he is just really living out his passion, you know? And from the perspective of looking directly at his face and just seeing the passion course through his veins, it was really an aha moment for me. It was spine tingling. In fact, I'm getting kind of the tingles right now thinking about it. Mm-hmm. And that night, you know, I went back to my apartment. The next morning I had woken up. I had brought a traveling easel with me to Paris. Interestingly enough, in English, we call it a French easel. Here I was in France with my French easel. And I had up to that point been too intimidated to go out in the streets or the alleys of Montmartre and start painting. But after witnessing that performance and seeing that conductor having his hell yes moment, you know, it was a huge inspiration for me. So I got up that next morning with easel in tow and a canvas, and self-consciousness be damned and intimidation be damned. I went right to the base of Montmartre, and at the very top of Montmartre, the highest point in Paris, is a cathedral called Basilique du Sacré-Cœur, the Basilica of the Sacred Heart, which sounds just like the perfect place to go to get in touch with your soul's purpose, you know?
Absolutely.
And all afternoon, I painted Basilique, and it was this tremendous experience. The French tourists and the French locals had nothing but good things to say. And so that evening, I went back to the apartment. I think I opened up a cheap bottle of Cote d'Oron, you know, and had an existential conversation with myself that ended with the conclusion that I'm going to become an artist and I'm going to move to California and open up this gallery, which was kind of, you know, brazen idea for somebody who hadn't studied art or didn't know the first thing about selling art. So that's the long story of how Steve ended up becoming an artist. And that was 25 years ago now, this year.
I love it. I love it. Thanks for telling that story. And I love it when, you know, people tell stories of those moments and you can really feel tangibly, like, you know, sitting there with you watching that conductor come alive. Fantastic. I think there's a lot of different directions we could go here. And I think, you know, hell yes, entrepreneurs, whether you're a visual artist or not, I think there's a lot to relate to there. Maybe there's some of you out there that are still in that kind of practical career that you're thinking about, well, maybe I want to follow my passion, but I'm just not sure. So maybe you can relate to that part of Steve's journey. Maybe you've already made that jump. Or maybe you're just at the beginning like I am, you know, I'm just kind of taking those steps into full-time entrepreneurship. I actually wanted to kind of maybe ask you about that, right? That period right there. So there you are, you have that moment, and then you go out and you have your first painting up at the cathedral. And then you kind of jumped to, and then I decided to open up a gallery in California. Can you drill us down a little bit into your thinking there? There's the moment where you decide to, like, I'm going to be an artist. And I want to hear a little bit about that period right there. Were you, like, when you made that decision, was it like, there's no doubt now, this is what I'm doing? Or was there kind of like, I'm doing this. Wait, am I doing this?
The hesitation, right?
Yeah, and then how did you, from that day to you getting to your art gallery in California, what was your journey there? I think this is for people like myself who are just kind of starting out. Maybe the road is still a bit fuzzy as to how to move forward, into a concrete thing like opening an art gallery.
Yeah, Norman, thanks for that question. You know, that little discussion that I just gave makes it almost sound like that this was a overnight epiphany, you know, and that's really not the case. I mean, I was, I think, really a seeker since childhood. Little backstory there. My father was a concentration camp survivor. Mm. He was from Luxembourg. and was taken to the concentration camps as actually a political hostage. On Christmas Eve, actually, came out of a Catholic church, Christmas Eve Mass. It's a long story. But when I was a sixth grader, I sat down with Dad and interviewed him about those dark times. And I think early on, especially after reading Viktor Frankl's book, Man's Search for Meaning, you know, there was this sense, and in that book, Frankl, a concentration camp survivor himself, talks about how he witnessed that there were people in the camps that either had a will to survive or not. And he comes to the conclusion, he develops actually, he's a psychologist, famous psychologist from Austria, develops this idea that he calls logotherapy that says, you know, those that had the will to survive had a love for something or for somebody. And, you know, so early on, already by sixth grade, I was asking myself and asked myself the question about my dad, what was his logotherapy, and by extension, what should mine be? You know, so by the time my journey had led me to Paris, these thoughts had been percolating for years, you know. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're often told, you know, what is it that makes you tick when you're a child? And well, there were a lot of things, but as we've talked about, you know, art was one of them. So it was fairly obvious to me that my passion, my logotherapy would have to have something to do with art. So, and I had visited California and was really inspired by the landscape and seascape there. And I felt like, that would be a good muse for me, you know. So in terms of location, you know, there was some history there. In terms of what I would do, you know, as I say, this had been kind of simmering for a long time. And then I felt like, well, you know, I'd been a management consultant. I'd been consulting businesses on how to be more productive and efficient and do things. And now I have this MBA. And so I wasn't, for want of confidence that I could make a business work, you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I think around about that time I also read, The Artist's Way, where the author really advocates, you know, jumping and the net will appear. I don't know if I want to give a full-throated support to that philosophy to your listeners, because it's a rocky road. You know, we know those that who've tried to step out of the normal path and do something entrepreneurial, you get beat up, you get smacked around, you learn some lessons. You know, and 25 years into it, Norman, I'm still getting smacked around and giving a go. So that path from, you know, long answer to your question, from Paris to Balboa Island, California, it was a rocky one, you know. And sadly at the time, you know, my dad was a huge inspiration to me. And you know, those of us who are children of immigrants, we know too that there's something of an entrepreneur in those kind of people. They have to have a certain exit velocity, I call it, to leave the comfort of their home, go somewhere else, in my dad's case, not even able to speak the language, and have the confidence that they can make a go of something. And so there's a real commonality, I think, between the entrepreneur and that kind of an immigrant. And so he was a huge inspiration to me. And sadly, he fell ill right when I was making this leap. And, you know, I was the first kid in the family to go to college. And he was very proud of that, proud that I was an engineer with an MBA and spoke multiple languages, et cetera. And, you know, here I was saying, Dad, thanks for all that support. But I'm going to go off and become an artist in California. And it was just a little too shocking for him. He fell ill shortly after that. I hope my choice didn't have anything to do with that. But right about that time, I had some artwork that made the cover of a magazine. And I sent that magazine to my parents. And my mom brought it to him when he was in the hospital. And I said, well, Mom, what did he say? And he said, sometimes that kid can be so smart and sometimes he can be so stupid. And that was the last I heard. My dad died a couple of days after that. And so that was the last, comment that I heard from him. So that has always sort of stuck in my craw. So there are those kind of personal things, too, that we have to deal with when we make the leap. What are friends and family going to say? And what's that going to mean to those kinds of relationships? And that's just something that we all have to deal with, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot there. You said something there I had never thought about. Both of my parents were immigrants. My mom came from Quebec, Canada, and my dad came from Scotland. Kind of I think an odd, not too many French Canadian Scottish couples that I can think of. But the idea of kind of the expatriate as entrepreneur or having an entrepreneurial sort of mindset. I really hadn't thought of them that way because they had pretty traditional thinking around their careers and so forth. But nevertheless, to really kind of like move to another country with nothing and start fresh. So I appreciate that. And it's like, oh, okay, yeah, maybe that's part of where this entrepreneurial instinct comes from. Yeah, and I, I'm not going to get into my side of it, but yeah, lots of complications on the family side of things as well. And my parents have both passed at this point, and I like to think that they're in their ideal spirit states. They're rooting me
right.
Yeah. Exactly. So there you are in California. I noticed one of your, by the way, I was born in Huntington Beach. I think some of your work was done there.
Yes.
So you can relate to that. So then what? So then you, you have a gallery, in California, and how long were you there? And then take us from there to Sedona.
Right. Well, The gallery experience, it definitely had its ups and downs. And I had the gallery for 8 years, and it was the best of times and the worst of times. There were times where, the bridge coming on the island is going to go under construction and nobody's going to be coming through for weeks or months at a time, And there's just the trials and travails of running a gallery while you're trying to be in creative headspace was a juggling act for sure. And I want to talk about kind of a defining moment that was actually a defining moment as a failure, really. And maybe your listeners can relate as well. I had done a couple coffee table books by this point in time where I was putting together paintings of specific areas, Newport Beach, Laguna Beach, Orange County. And I would write poetry to go with these paintings, and I put them together in these coffee table books. And California as a state was about to celebrate its 150th anniversary in the year 2000. And I thought, wow, what a perfect reason to do a coffee table book of California to celebrate the what's called the sesquicentennial. That's how you say 150 years. I know, right? sesquicentennial of California statehood in the year 2000. It's all round numbers. This is perfect, right? So, Norman, I traveled 25,000 miles around California, working on a 60-piece collection of paintings, and then writing poems and putting them together in this large format coffee table book. And I thought, okay, this is going to be my big splash, right? And I had to borrow, beg, and steal $60,000 to get this book off the ground, self-publishing. And at the time, Bill Jones was the Secretary of State of California. He was heading up in the state legislature the committee to celebrate California's sesquicentennial. And got to meet his daughter totally by chance. She actually walked through my gallery one day. So this is one of these sort of providential moments, these sort of serendipitous moments that we people that jump off and take risks like to think, you know, should come our way. Mm-hmm. And I was like, well, this is the moment, you know. So she introduced me to her father. I went up to Sacramento in his palatial office, met with him, told him what I was working on, said I was looking for a single buyer for the complete collection of paintings, and then to have these paintings travel around the state of California, to specifically the state parks, and the sale of the books and prints would benefit the California state parks. He loved the idea, introduced me to the powers that be at the state parks foundation, actually, and they were helping me to find a single buyer for the collection and setting up this program that would have the collection travel around to the state parks and sell these books. Well, it's a long story, but a variety of weird political things happened. And I'm not much of a politician. I felt like I was kind of stuck inside the beltway when it was happening. And I had to make the decision, you know, do I print these books or not? And I pulled the trigger and invested the $60,000 in printing these books in China. And the books were literally on the slow boat from China, right? Mm-hmm. And I get this call from Bill Jones' deputy, Secretary of State, saying, Steve, you haven't printed those books yet, have you? Oh. And I was like, yeah, you know, they're literally on the container on the slow boat. And he says, oh, the whole thing's falling apart. And, yeah. And I don't want to get into the politics of it, but it was an ugly scene. And, you know, my 10,000 copies showed up in the port of L.A. Ugh. Without any real game plan. And I, you know, was able to sell some of them, but not nearly what I had anticipated. And it was financially pretty rough sledding through that process. And, you know, I think you can probably relate to the idea of negativity bias. When those kinds of things happen to you, they stick with you. And then when I've had to sort of consciously train myself, when I'm looking at a new project, don't think back to the failure that happened that time. Learn something from it and try to move on. Because I think there's a psychology, this negativity bias. You know, psychologists and sociologists tell us that, you know, it takes however many good things to overshadow that one bad thing, and those one bad things tend to stick in your mind. So that for me was, I think, a real learning moment in a variety of ways. To first not let those kind of negative things hamper future projects, but also I think in the West, and particularly in the United States, we're very prone to linear active thinking. You know, definitely as an engineer and as a management consultant, you have this idea of a project that starts at A, goes through B, and ends at C, and we walk ourselves through those steps, and by golly, we're going to get there in the end, you know? Mm-hmm. And sometimes it just doesn't work that way, and sometimes the approach is a nonlinear approach is better. A sort of intuitive unfolding of a process sometimes works better than that linear, I'm going to slam this thing through kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that probably is maybe a segue to what I'd like to talk about now, which is the great peacemakers. But yeah. If you have another question, I don't want to monopolize the direction.
Yeah. That works out well, because my next question was about, actually the two things I'd like to talk about are that project, and then also your idea, the concept of the heart throb and the heartache, but I think those go together. So
yes.
Start where you would like to.
Great question. Thank you. So in California, I had this gallery for about 8 years. And at some point, my wife, who had lived previously in Arizona, was pretty familiar with Sedona, and I had never been. And she said, you know, Steve, you're an oil painter and you've never been to Sedona, a landscape painter, and you've never been to Sedona. That's almost criminal, you know? And so I said, you know, babe, you're right. Let's go to check that out. And, you know, I got here and I thought, wow, what's the rest of the world thinking? I want to live there someday, you know? And literally, Norman, 2 weeks later, our house was up for sale. 2 months later, we had moved, you know, another one of these, you know, let's just go do it kind of moments. And so I'd been painting at this point for 15 or more years, and I'd been painting an awful lot of landscape, and I got here and did another coffee table book of Sedona. And after a few years, I thought, well, I want to try some, start painting some different things. And it was right about that time that Nelson Mandela fell ill. He's right over my shoulder back there on the wall. And you know, he was in the news, and I thought to myself, you know, yeah, I know who Nelson Mandela is and vaguely what he did, but I didn't really have a real solid understanding of the impact of his work and you know, what it means to the broader world. And so I just wanted to learn more about that. And that inspired me to do this painting that, as I say, is over my shoulder. And I thought, well, that was fun. You know, maybe I should keep doing that. And so the idea was struck that I would start studying these great peacemakers, for lack of a better term, and start painting them and put them into a collection. And, to my previous comment about linear thinking versus letting things unfold and letting them intuitively happen, I decided this project for the first time was just going to be like that. I was just going to start painting these. I wasn't going to worry about, you know, how I was going to promote it or what I was going to do, and just let the whole thing kind of unfold. And that's part of the process I'm still in now. So I started that project about 7 years ago, Norman, and now I have the paintings done, or at least 95% done. And now I'm sitting down and thinking through, well, what do I want to say about these peacemakers? So I'm going through each of them. I've researched each of them quite substantially even before doing the paintings, and I'm writing about them. And, the theme of the collection has been, Martin Luther King's quote of the arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends towards justice. And so by my estimation, each of these luminaries are arc benders. You know, they're the ones that have been making these things happen. And so I'm writing a biographical essay to go with each of them that talks about, well, what exactly have they done to help bend this arc, you know? And so I have that pretty far along. And then I'm taking a step back and saying, well, if I look at 36 of these, what collectively do I think I've learned that I want to impart to readers, you know, that I think is beneficial to making this world a more peaceful place? And that's where things have gotten interesting, and I think relate again to the Hell Yes entrepreneur and about the notion of heartthrob and heartache that you just brought up. Mm-hmm. So as I was looking at these peacemakers, I asked myself, is there a particular archetype, a particular kind of person that they are? And I wasn't finding that, but you know, along the way, I studied different sort of programs of archetypes. You know, there's Gurdjieff's Enneagram, and there's Carl Jung's archetypes, and you know, a variety of these sort of archetyping systems. And I came across what I thought was a fascinating book, and I'll direct your listeners to his website here in a moment. But the book is The Five Dharma Types by Simon Chokoisky, and it's ancient Vedic wisdom, so from ancient India. And he comes up with, he's dug through ancient writings and came up with this notion that there's really these five archetypes that he calls Dharma types. And sadly, those archetypes have been bastardized to form the current India caste system. But in the ancient times, these five archetypes were the merchant, the laborer, the warrior, the educator, and the outsider. And you can see how those may relate to the current caste system. But what's fascinating, as I was looking at the peacemakers, I discovered that the majority of them were either warriors, interestingly enough, or educators. Not all of them, but many of them. Okay. And that many of them earlier in their life were not working in a realm that was consistent with their archetype. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And this is, I think, real important for your listeners is it has been for me, because I didn't realize until relatively recently that I'm an educator. Hmm. You know, all the roles previous to what I do now were not educative roles, you know. And you know, we're often told, you know, you can do whatever you want, put your mind to it, and you can do whatever you want in this world. And I think that is true within certain limitations. I think it's true within the limitation of our archetype. So let me use a couple examples, just two examples from The Peacemaker that I think will illustrate the point. One is Mother Teresa. So Mother Teresa, you know, ends up in Calcutta as a nun. That's her passion, is to be a nun from the age of 11 on. She ends up in Calcutta, and she is a teacher at her convent there, eventually becomes headmistress of the school and is fairly successful at that, but she's not famous with it, you know. And she does this for many years, and she's starting to get burnt out on it. And so she's in an educator role, but she's not an educator. She is a laborer archetype. So she's not operating within her archetype, okay? So she goes on a sabbatical. And she has, in her biography, she calls it the call within the call. And she says that's when she realized she needed to tend to the poorest of the poor living in Calcutta, right? Mm. Not to be the headmistress of a school. She then appealed to the Pope in Rome to establish a new order, which became the Missionaries of Charity. She returns to Calcutta. And then in her proper archetype role as a laborer, she tends to the poorest of the poor, the destitute and dying of Calcutta. And now she is living within that proper archetype. Okay, so this was a person that was operating within an educator role when they should have been operating within a laborer role, and eventually did, and it worked out. Now let me give you the converse of that is John Muir. John Muir, you know, if you don't know, he a tremendous conservationist, actually hails originally from Scotland. You'll be proud to learn. And his parents immigrated to Wisconsin. And he is living in the Midwest and is working as a machinist, right? Fully a laborer role. And he has an accident, a machining accident. And a metal burr flies up into his eye, and he goes blind temporarily in one eye, and the other eye actually goes sympathy blind. And you know, that was a medical term, but he lost the sight of both eyes. And eventually it comes back, and he says, God has to nearly kill us sometimes to teach us a lesson. And he then goes on a walk. He's the original Forrest Gump. He goes on a walk from Indianapolis to the Gulf Coast of Florida, you know, documenting plants along the way because he was fascinated by nature. Eventually, through a weird twist of fate, up in California, and it's in California that he starts really studying, you know, the Sierra Nevada. He calls it the Range of Light, and writing books about everything that he had learned about nature, and actually is the one that comes up with the theory that glaciation had caused so much of the formation. So he ends up, you know, starting off as this laborer, but his archetype is the educator, right? Mm-hmm. He then eventually becomes the educator. Now he's operating within his realm, right? So that's the first thing I want to talk about as being important, is understanding what your archetype is. This is really critically important. Mm-hmm. And so you know, in Simon's book, the author of Five Dharma Types, it's a really great read. I'm only just glossing the surface with this. There's so much rich information there. But he has a website called spirittype.com. And I would really encourage your listeners to visit that. And he gives you, there's an opportunity there to take a quiz. You know, you answer some questions and it should be revelatory. It'll reveal what your archetype is. To my mind, very important for those of us who are trying to figure out what the heck should we be doing, you know? Mm-hmm. So that's the first thing. So this is what I had found with peacemakers is so many of them finally get their archetype right, you know, and that's where they take off. Now, you had mentioned this other sort of philosophy I have called the heart throb and the heart ache. This is sort of the second piece of it, you know? So the heart throb is, you know, sort of the Joseph Campbell mentality of follow your bliss, right? We've heard this all before. You know, what makes you tick? You know, what did you like to do as a kid? Some of us have a hard time trying to figure out what our heart throb is. And for others, it's real easy, you know? But it's only part of the equation. At least I've found this to be the case as I have studied the peacemakers, because they'll come around to doing what they love, just as I came around to doing painting that I loved, right? But as I say, it's only half the equation. The other half of the equation is, what is our heartache? So again, with let's use Mother Teresa again as that example. What was her heart throb? Well, she learned at 11 years old, she wanted to be a nun. That was her heart throb, to work in the service of God, so to speak, you know? And, but her star doesn't take off until she marries that heartthrob to the heartache. And what's the heartache? The heartache is the, you know, the destitute people, the dying people that she sees in the streets and the slums of Calcutta. And she marries that heartthrob to the heartache and her star takes off. John Muir again, his passion is botany and nature. And yes, he hikes all over the Sierra Nevadas and he writes about it. But his heartache is the fact that they're going to dam up Yosemite and destroy Yosemite. Right? He can't have that. So he marries his heartthrob to his heartache and his star takes off. And now just about everything you come across in California is one way or another named after John Muir, you know, the founder of the Sierra Club as well. And so those are the things that, at least in studying the great peacemakers, and, you know, I don't know that you can call the great peacemakers entrepreneurs. I guess you can. They're almost specialized entrepreneurs. They're entrepreneurs that aren't really worried about making money. They're entrepreneurs that are worried about changing the world.
Yeah.
And so as I study them, that's the conclusion I came to is, firstly, they get their archetype right. They figure out, you know, okay, I'm either the educator, the warrior, the merchant, the laborer, or the outsider. And they operate within that archetype. Then they understand what makes them tick, what their heart throb is, and they finally marry that with what the heartache is, and it all comes together.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And so that's, I think, what I've learned from well, there's a variety of things I've learned from the peacemakers, but as it relates, I think, best to the entrepreneurial path, that would be it.
Great. Wow. Thanks for sharing all that and for gleaning those lessons. And I mean, it sounds like that's interesting that you've sort of evolved. Like, so you would you say your archetype is educator?
Yeah. So, I mean, I've had to, you know, suffer through asking those same questions of myself. So if I want to use myself as an example, if I can be so bold, you know, my heartthrob obviously is to paint or to create, and maybe even to storytell through my art. You know, the heartache is looking and seeing a world that is in ways starving for peace, you know, and I think my dad's experience in the camps kind of set me up with that notion from early childhood on, you know, and this collection and this effort's definitely dedicated to him. You know, so that's my heartthrob and heartache. And I've realized, well, I have to educate through my art, You know, that's my archetype. So and artists are interesting, you know, with this sort of newfound understanding of the archetypes, I find it fascinating actually to go into galleries and look at the artwork and try to understand what that artist archetype is. That's one thing that's unique about the field of art, is you really can be any one of the archetypes. But as an artist, you have to know that archetype and have it work through your art, you know? So that's my current passion right now, is as I bring all those three components together, archetype, the heartthrob and the heartache, is to make my work come together in this Peacemaker collection. So the goal of the collection is to find a single buyer for the complete collection, and to find a permanent venue for it where the artwork and the prose and the videos that I do with it. I haven't talked about that, but I do a video to go with each painting. That is also educational, and I'd like to think inspirational in nature as well. So I'd like to find a venue where this collection finds a permanent home and is used as an educational tool. At the same time, I'm also creating a traveling exhibit of the art where I'm reproducing the paintings on banners with, again, educational information and little QR codes that you can scan that take you to videos of the painting. That again, hopefully help to make this world a more peaceful place. So that's what I'm doing to try to, you know, take my own medicine at this point. Does that make sense, Norman?
Yeah, absolutely. I love it. Love it, what you're doing. And I'm just going to put it out there, Hell Yes Entrepreneur listeners, if you or anyone you know or have, you know, like 3 degrees out that you think might be interested in buying Steve's collection, then, you know, I'm going to we're going to have the links in the show notes to Steve's website. Please get in touch with him, or any tips or ideas that you have to help him move forward on his mission, which is a great one. I also wanted to mention, I wanted to call out that thing that you said about the call within the call. I like that phrase. I mean, I guess it was Mother Teresa that said that, right?
Yeah.
And so, and this idea, Hell Yes Entrepreneurs, just to think about, I'm in the midst of this too, sort of thinking, because we have this quote on the podcast that I bring up all the time. It's attributed to Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs, ask what makes you come alive and go do it, because what the world needs is people who have come alive, right? So that, I think, addresses the heart throb piece. But, you know, for some of, and, you know, I think that the gist of that quote is, go live your passion. That is how you can be of service, right? But, and so I would say, for people out there, like, yeah, you know, if that is painting or singing or whatever it is, then do that. For some people like me and maybe other people out there, and obviously you, Steve, there is part being of service in some way is a part of that. And so I'm kind of trying to listen for direction on how that shows up in what I'm doing as well. It is that extra level of feeling of giving back or of meaning. And so I really resonate with what you're saying there. And thanks so much for sharing all that. So we should probably start to wind down now. And I always like to, I want to maybe ask you the question I don't ask all the time, but is this idea of your cringeworthy vision. So this is a vision so big that it makes you cringe to think about sharing it. And now I'm giving you the opportunity to share about it now. So do you have you're working on this amazing project right now, but you know, even, you know, like whether it's about this or something else, what do you have a big vision for your life or for the world? I don't know, anything.
Yeah, I think the cringeworthy vision really is the Great Peacemakers project in a lot of ways. And there's times that I wake up and a whole new idea comes to head. I want to turn this into a film. I want to turn, you know, and or whatever. But I think it's a little bit of a brash idea that you have ideas on how to make the world a more peaceful place, you know. Yeah. And that's a little bit cringeworthy, you know. Who am I? I'm not the next Buddha or anything, you know. So I'm not trying to put forth the world according to Steve. I'm really trying to dive into what did these peacemakers say, these three dozen luminaries, and why aren't we listening to them? I feel like, I'm trying to shake the tree, which is interesting. Again, Mandela over my shoulder, his original name was not Nelson, it's Roli Lala. And in his native tongue, it actually means, it means he who shakes the tree, or more colloquially, the troublemaker, So this, I think, is what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to shake that tree to say, hey, we need to listen to what these people have been doing or telling us, and what they have watched, what they've been doing. And I'm trying to put that together in one place and with a certain amount of insightful analysis on my own to say, here's, I think, the path forward, And that's pretty cringeworthy, Every once in a while I go, what am I doing? who am I to do that? So I'm trying to stay as true as I can to their ideas and not allow my own sort of perspectives to filter into it. But that's I think where I'm at with the project, and cringeworthy enough, I'd like to think.
I love that. And it what it's funny that we would be living in a world where you have to feel like cringeworthy about talking about peace. Oh gosh, hey everybody, I think maybe we could have more peace in the world. Sorry to even bring this up. I know everybody's more interested in Game of Thrones or something like that. But great to hear that. And I always like to wrap up by saying hell yes on the count of three with my guests. Are you willing to do that?
Yes, indeed.
Okay. And so I used to do kind of a long hell yes. Now it's kind of more of a hell yes. So we'll be doing hell yes together.
All right.
Ready? One, two, three.
Hell yes.
Well, Steve, thanks so much for joining me, and best of luck with all the great work that you're doing.
Thank you, Norman. Likewise, it's been a real pleasure.
Thanks for joining me for this episode of the Hell Yes Life podcast. You can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or your favorite RSS feed. If you like the show, please leave a rating and review. And if you want to stay connected, visit hellyeslife.com and sign up for the e-newsletter and private Facebook group. Again, I'm Norman Bell. Thanks for joining me. Now let's get out there and live a hell yes life.